Hello, and welcome to a ThinkWorks special series, as your hosts Darren Smithson and Steve Lowe take us to the realm of unexplained mysteries.
Hello everyone and welcome to a special edition of ThinkWorks, because it's the first of a series within a series. So we're going to be doing some breakout episodes about unexplained mysteries, and that we is me and the Professor, Steve Lowe. Hi Steve.
Hi Darren. Hello everyone.
And what we're going to do is we're going to talk on this first episode of Unexplained Mysteries, which is why it was a slightly different theme tune. We're going to talk about Jack the Ripper. The mystery around him and everything else, and I think we both picked this one first, didn't we?
Well, it's an unsolved mystery, isn't it?
It is.
It's not like a conspiracy. I mean, the murders definitely took place, yeah. But it's like, who did it?
Yes.
Who was he? And also, importantly, who were the victims?
Now, to set a couple of warnings, the first thing is we want to focus on the victims in this, so we will actually explain in some graphic detail what was done to them. So if you have a weak disposition, you may want to fast forward those bits. And secondly, you will hear mouse clicks and paper rustling during this episode, and that's because we wanted to get the names and dates exactly right.
Correct.
And we're old men, and our minds aren't as agile as they were for remembering things.
But for the people who need details, what we've done in the description of some of the murders, which were horrific, is we have summarised. I have read, through research, the post-mortem reports, and I think they're too graphic to discuss on a podcast. It was quite upsetting just to listen to them, so to read them. But if you do need details, then they're out there.
Wow. I didn't go that far, because I just reading what we've done upsetting enough. Right, so unless you've lived on another planet, let's just set the scene, really. There was a timeline of terror, a reign of terror. And it really is like the movies. It's those dark alleyways of smog-bound London and 1888.
I think, as well, just to add to that background, I mean, this was in the East End of London, Whitechapel mainly. And you had opium dens, you had brothels, and they were actually alongside where people were living with families and kids were playing. They had a lot of alcoholism.
Yeah.
There was violence was commonplace. Lots of people were in poverty. So it was a dire place to live.
Yeah. Into that atmosphere of an already violent London, part of London, came these murders, these horrendous murders, starting with Marianne Nichols, also known as Polly Nichols. And that was in August 1888. Now, we're going to talk about each of the victims in more detail in a moment, but let's just keep setting initially this, try to get this kind of a fear across that happened within Whitechapel, because newspapers at that time were like just daily out there on the streets almost immediately, with billboards and newspaper lads in the corner of the street shouting murder, murder.
But the murders were so brutal and they're quite inhumane that after the first probably two, I think it was, it captured the attention of the entire world, because no country, not necessarily seen it, but certainly had not reported on what was happening, obviously, in Whitechapel.
Yeah. So the first murder started, the first murder occurred, rather, on August the 31st, 1888, and the last of the canonical murders, and we'll explain what we mean about that later in this episode, occurred on November the 9th, 1888. And Jack the Ripper wasn't known as Jack the Ripper at first.
He was known as the Whitechapel Murderer, because at the time there had been some other murders of women and prostitutes. Yeah. So they hadn't differentiate between the two.
No.
It's only when they got a letter talking about these murders and doing some reference to one of the Connaughtal Five.
Yeah.
And he signed it Jack the Ripper. Now, the police thought it was a hoax at the time, but the papers picked up on it and it just stuck.
It just stuck. Yes, and it's quite interesting. I mean, he did have, in that letter, if memory serves, he did put some details that hadn't been released to the press.
We'll go into this later, but there was some confusion, though, about the date stamp on the actual letter that he sent. So when it was written and when it was posted. So there's a little bit of confusion there, which we'll try and discuss that later.
Okay, so we'll talk about that letter and its impact on the investigation a little bit later as well. So we've set the scene. It's the fog-bound London that you see in all the Hammer horror movies. And you've got a mysterious murderer targeting mostly survival sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
And basically each crime escalating.
Correct.
In the horrific injuries that was subjected to each of the
women.
It
seemed to get worse as his rage got worse as well. I mean, the thing is, they all took place within a mile of each other.
Yeah.
And they all had certain attributes, as well as being mutilated in a very sadistic manner. The way he killed them and then what he did afterwards had never been heard of or seen before. And so not reported on.
No, and and you have to remember back then, folks, the term serial killer didn't exist. It wasn't.
No.
It
no.
wasn't something no. that was even considered, I think, by law enforcement officers. And yet, suddenly, you had this series of murders, definitely connected, in a way that basically seemed to suggest that the killer had either some kind of understanding of the human anatomy, or was exploring human anatomy just through his rage.
In fact, it was after the fourth murder of Catherine Eddowes. The police surgeon, a Dr. Frederick Gordon Brown, he said the fact that he actually could remove organs,
yes,
like he did.
Yes.
He must have had some understanding of the position of where these organs were.
Yeah.
And the removal was quite clean. Although the brutality of the murder was very, barbaric, how he was dissected these poor victims meant that he actually knew how to work around a body. He knew how to actually dissect it.
Yeah, and I think that one is we'll come to each of the individual victims later, but I think that one is particularly gruesome. Yeah. So we've set the scene, so let's now talk about, I think, the victims themselves.
Yeah. I think it's an important point as well, because ourselves included, for 130-odd years now, everybody around the world has talked about Jack the Ripper. There's been documentaries, films, books. Everybody's been speculating about his identity and who he is. And he's still remembered to this day. The thing is, his victims have been largely forgotten.
Yes.
I mean, I will be honest with you, I couldn't have named one victim until I started looking into this.
And it kind of, again, it speaks to that almost like, well, they were sex workers. It's kind of like, you know,
just
disregard them to the annals of history. But actually, regardless of how they ended up being a sex worker, and some of their stories are tragic, the fact that they were still someone's daughter, some of them were someone's mother.
Correct.
And it's just horrific what happened
to them. It is. And when you look at the individuals, there was reasons why they became sex workers.
Yeah.
The reason why they fell into poverty. The reason why they turned to drink. Because it was a very tough time in that for everybody. And they went through tragedies. They got divorced, they lost people. People had died who they loved. And they felt they had no hope.
And it wasn't like today where we had a society that would come around and put a safety net under people.
Or benefits and stuff like that. And I just want to point out, Darren, at the end of the day, I know it's a long time ago, there were human beings who probably had hopes and aspirations to get out of the situation, and that was cut short.
Yeah, I mean, I was just about to say, in fact, you know, I made that comment about they were just sex workers. That's not us saying that. That was the belief, especially amongst the law enforcement of that time. And in some respects, those attitudes haven't really changed that much. It's almost as if, because they were sex workers, anything that happens to them is brought upon them by their own actions,
which is wrong.
And we just want to make that very clear. So let's go and talk about each of the five canonical, and again, we'll explain what we mean about that when we finish these five. Let's go through them in the timeline and by each of the individual women that were caught up in this series of murders. So first was Mary Ann Nichols, also known as Polly Nichols.
Polly, yeah.
And that was, as we said, in August 1988.
I mean, she was actually obviously the first victim, but she led a life of marked hardships. I mean, she was born in 1845 and married in 1864. So I think she was, what, 20, 21, is it? No, they're 19, actually. But she had five children.
Yeah.
So she was a mother, right? And was doing quite well. Then, unfortunately, the husband split up and she had to start scraping by. And what she did, she turned to prostitution because that's the easiest way of making money in that time.
So the story goes with Polly that she had made her daily lodgings money three times over, but had been to a pub and drunk away most of the profits.
Correct, and it was at the Frying Pan Pub.
Yeah, what a great name for
a pub. I think it's called, yeah. Yeah. The thing is as well, she knew that she spent the money on drink, and she went back to the lodgings and didn't have the money, so the landlord turned her away. So she, and apparently she'd acquired this bonnet, whether she'd given it, stolen it, we don't know, but she acquired this bonnet, and she said to the landlord, "Keep my bed."
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to get the money. I'll be back soon. I've got my lovely bonnet for the Doss House.
Yes.
Words to that effect.
And then she stepped out into the night.
She did.
And not much more is known.
Well, she. I think what the police record said, according to a witness, a lady called Emily Holland, at about 2:30, she saw Polly, and realised that she was drunk, and asked to go back to the Doss House, the lodgings.
Yeah.
And Polly says, "No, I need to get some money. I'm going to go out and earn it because I've got my pretty bonnet."
Now, the really horrific thing about all this is that he slashed her throat. The killer slashed her throat, but he did it so deeply, her head was almost decapitated.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a cut of the throat.
The police surgeon at the autopsy said you could see a spine.
Yeah.
Through the cut, it was that deep, so it nearly severed her head.
So it's a strong. We're not talking about a woman really doing these murders, because it was such a dramatically strong cut or slash.
Exactly.
To get that.
Yeah, that there, yeah.
To get that. So you had that blow that nearly decapitated her, but there were more. There's more details to that killing that have come out.
I mean, in I think most of the victims, it's four out of the five of the victims, when they were examined. The tongue was bloated, and on the bits of the neck that were still visible, there was lots of bruising. It does indicate that they were actually strangled to death first,
yes,
and then the throats were cut. And the reason why that was done is that he could cut the throat. He always turned the head to one side. That victim would bleed out, but because the heart had stopped, it wasn't spurting blood, which means he wasn't going to get covered in blood.
Correct.
And so that's why he strangled them first,
yeah.
So there's less blood to be in there.
I mean, it's just that cold-blooded approach to... It's like that strange dichotomy, isn't it? He planned ahead enough that he didn't want to get any blood on him. He planned ahead that he wanted to strangle them and then cut them in such a way that he didn't get blood on him.
Exactly.
But then he slashed with such force.
I mean, this is the case of most of them. Well, I mean, he always used to target the woman's abdomen and sometimes in the genitalia. In this case, that Polly had been completely disemboweled.
Yeah.
Basically, all the lower organs have been taken out. What one of the police officers witnessed as well is that this little lovely bonnet that was going to get her to her money was laying next to her.
Right.
Murdered. So. And she was 42 years old.
Yeah. Which even back then was no age, really. I mean, I know people didn't live anywhere near as long as they do today, but...
Yeah. But the thing was, I think what's as well is that, and I think this is for quite a few of the victims, much, much later on, or not immediately, a lot of the local councils and that, they've actually put plaques to where they believe these victims were murdered, and people can go visit, and your people leave flowers, but they also leave coins, and guess what they leave?
What?
The equivalent of 4 pence, because it was 4 pence for a night of lodging.
Right.
And if she'd have had that 4 pence that night,
she wouldn't have been the first victim.
The Ripper. There's another little strange coincidence as well, regarding Polly. Her body was actually taken in secrecy, because they didn't want the crowds going, right? And it was taken to a place called Ambury Street. The Ripper's second victim was murdered in Ambury Street. How about that? Strange.
Yeah.
Read into that what you may.
Yes. So, that's poor Polly. And then the second victim, Annie Chapman, and the viciousness was even more explicitly.
It was escalating.
It was, even by the second victim.
Yeah, he seemed like he was getting more excited or agitated or frenzied, whatever they call it. But yeah, they were just getting worse and worse.
Yeah, and the date of Annie's was September the 8th, so literally a week later than Polly.
Yeah.
And she was found in a backyard at Hanbury Street.
But from her background, I mean, she was basically raised by her father.
Yeah.
Her mother had left a long time ago. But her father died by committing suicide, which then tipped Annie over the edge, and she turned to drink even at a young age to try and deal with that. But she was married. She was married, and she had they had children. And it seems like the children caused an issue, and her and her husband then split up. At the time when they split up, he was given an allowance.
Yeah,
like he would do now. You know, you'd have what's it called in these days? You know, but
yeah, alimony.
Alimony. But he died not long after they split up, and so her money run out.
Yeah.
So although she was a decent lady at the time, she then turned to casual sex work to get some money.
Right. And she was, her injuries were, this is where he started to remove the uterus and really get into some severe mutilation of the abdomen.
There's the similar pattern to what happened to Polly. But he then started taking, with Annie, he removed the intestines and laid them out round side the body. You mentioned about the uterus. Again, he targeted the genitalia, which indicates he had some problem maybe with women or certainly with prostitutes. But he also took her womb away.
Yeah.
He cut it cleanly, but was never found. So whether he took that and threw it away or took it for, a trophy, he obviously was getting really sadistic at that time.
Yeah. If it's possible to become even more sadistic than the first murder.
So after the second victim of Annie Chapman, it became clear to the police, and I think the Daily Telegraph reported it, that not only did they have a serial killer on the loose, which was a new term at that time, they then started, the paper started drawing attention to the fact, why is this happening? And they're looking at the poverty.
Yeah.
That's happening in Whitechapel and other areas of London, but Whitechapel was the focus.
Because we have to say that the Jack the Ripper murders weren't the only murders of women, violent murders of women, at that time in London. Yeah. And in that area in particular, there were other murders that were unrelated, but just as horrific in their own way. Mm. There might have been a one-off rather than a serial killer involved, but they were still horrific. And it was the fact that there were so many murders, particularly of women, in that time. The police were it was almost as if, well, first of all, they were overstretched.
Mm.
But also, I think the police had become kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, when you become hardened to something that's happened. That's it. I think that was part of the problem, really, in those initial investigations.
Because it's not like, say, it's after the second one, they went, well, this is not just a murder. There's patterns here, and they are so brutal at what being done to these poor women that they had to sit up and start going, we've got a problem here. Because people were getting worried then, and there was chance of riots, and people weren't trusting the police. And so, it got a bit more focus after the second one.
Yeah, and then we had, obviously, the murder of Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes on September the 30th.
Same night. I mean, the difference between Elizabeth Stride, who she called Stride because she married a chap called Stride, she was actually Swedish. So she wasn't originally raised in Whitechapel. So she came from a decent background in Sweden. Moved over here, married her husband, but they had a very volatile relationship and they separated quite early on in the marriage. In 81.
Yeah.
She was then divorced, single. She then, like the previous two, she turned to sex work to make ends meet. She also then became an alcoholic, turned to drink.
Which is, it seems to be a pattern that we start to see in the kind of hardships.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, when you see people in real hardship, in real poverty, they do turn to drink and drugs. It's an outlet and the criminal element with the drugs as well, but it's an outlet that takes them away from their reality for a short while.
Exactly. But the thing with Elizabeth, she wasn't destitute. She used to clean rooms in lodging houses, including the one she stayed in, to get enough money, A, to pay for a board, and then B, to obviously allow her to go drinking, which is what she spent most of her spare money on.
Yeah. But with Elizabeth, although the throat was cut in the same typical way that the other two victims had been, the theory is that before he could proceed with any more of his macabre experiments, he was interrupted.
Mm. Yeah. I think also, obviously she was still obviously murdered brutally, but I think what is interesting here is that there was a I think it was a Pole, it might have been a Polish Jew, I don't know if it was, called Israeli Schwartz.
Yeah.
And the reason why I mention it, because it's quite interesting, because he recognised Liz, she was known as, and he saw her with a man having an argument. Now, she didn't realise, he thought at first it was maybe a domestic discussion about something. So he crossed the road. As he crossed the road, he came across another man who was actually lighting a pipe. And it, apparently, allegedly, the chap who was assaulting Liz shouted to the other man, called something, I can't remember what he called, Lipsky, I think it was, which is like, I think it's a derogatory name for Jews. Obviously, Schwartz got panicked. He started walking away, but this other guy started following him, right? Eventually shook him off, right?
Yeah.
What I find interesting about this is two things. One is there a second person involved?
Yeah.
The police discounted this later on. But the other really fascinating fact is Schwartz was probably the only person to see the Ripper at the start of a murder.
Yeah.
And he then gave a testament, although he couldn't speak, he gave a testament through an interpreter of what he'd seen.
Yeah.
And they tried from that to build up an image. And it's the only time the police had any kind of image of what this chap could look like.
Now, we've gone to the two murders on the 30th. So we've talked about Elizabeth. And then there's a second murder on the same night, which is Catherine Eddowes. And this one, he went back into his method of how he killed and disemboweled.
It seems like he couldn't do what he wanted to do to Elizabeth Stride. He was disturbed. It then seemed he took his rage out on Catherine, the next one, because up until that point, Catherine was the most brutal, sadistic murder of the four so far.
Yeah, because he mutilated her face, which he hadn't done with the others. Yeah. Again, that chilling kind of, I didn't get to vent my evil doing on one victim, so he upped it for the next one. It's when you think the human psyche can actually think in those kind of terms or react in those kind of ways, it's scary, really.
It is scary. And I think what's quite sad and ironic in a way is she had been drinking in a pub and with the friends, locals, and she was that drunk at 8 o'clock she collapsed in the street. Police found her, couldn't revive her, and took her to Bishopsgate Police Station, put her in a cell to sober up. At midnight, 12:30, I think, something like that, she came through from her comatose state, was singing, said she was okay, and she was released at 12:30.
Wow.
Right. And it then was at 1:45, and that her body was discovered.
Wow.
So
it's almost like she was followed from the police station, which really then starts to raise my eyebrow, because that's two murders now that have got connection to law enforcement, because the one that was found behind the coroners, and then this one with the poor unsuspecting lady released from a police cell.
Exactly. And the thing that we will touch on it later, obviously disemboweled again, lots of really horrible stuff done, like she had her eyelids removed, her cheeks had little cuts in it, V-shapes in it. But one thing that the Ripper allegedly took away is the left kidney.
Yes.
He took away the left kidney. That was not found anywhere at all. So, yeah.
Again, was it a trophy? For all we know, he may have been making pies. I mean,
it sounds horrible, Or is it? Like I say, is it just a trophy? Is it just? Well, obviously, it was a mental.
Yeah, nutter. I mean, what's scary about this is that there could be a house in London somewhere that has got a partition behind a hollow wall, and there's all these horrendous trophies just there waiting to be discovered even today.
And this is just a conspiracy theory going into obviously a murder serial killer, should I say. There is, because those two murders that same night, and they were within an hour or so of each other, there was already lots of police around after the first murder.
Yeah.
There's a question is, how could he get through, do the second murder, and then still get away?
Yeah.
Yeah. And isn't there there's a clue what was left behind? There's part of an apron.
Yes.
That they found blood on it, and also some feces as well.
Yeah.
On it, where they think, because it's found in a little alleyway, it stopped, because he was obviously he's in a panic, to wipe blood off whatever, his knife, his clothes or whatever, and then he discarded his apron, which was found by a police officer. Nothing was ever done about it.
No.
I accept they didn't have the forensic DNA stuff that we have now, but nothing was ever done about it.
No. Because I still think that despite all the sensationalism that was going on with the press and the public, the police, to a certain extent, were dealing with a violent community on its own right anyway, and had become hardened against those kind of murders, especially when a sex worker was concerned. Mm. Now, there's no evidence, I don't think, with Catherine that she was a sex worker at all. She was just drunk.
Yeah, but people said that she was quite a jolly person, and a friend said there's no evidence that she was ever a sex. She's the only one who possibly wasn't a sex worker.
The Ripper just basically frustrated with his first kill going wrong. She was just the one that crossed his path.
He was quite opportunistic in his way, but the fact that he was always looking for drunk, possibly prostitutes.
Yeah.
After midnight.
Yeah.
That's the pattern.
Yeah. It's scary, really. So that was Catherine. And then the final of the five murders that are definitely associated with Jack the Ripper because of evidence was on November the 9th, again, just over a week later. And this was Mary Jane Kelly.
And I think we thought that Catherine was pretty gruesome. We've talked about he was escalating in his type of violence. Mary Jane Kelly was by far the most gruesome.
Because it happened in her own home.
Because she actually had lodgings.
Yes.
And therefore took Jack back to her lodgings. He had time to do what he ended up doing.
Absolutely scary. I mean, he removed her organs.
Right.
He actually arranged them around the room and then had time to clean himself up.
Hmm.
But and leave without detection.
Mary was the youngest. I mean, all the others were in the 40s. Although she turned to drink at the time. I mean, she's from Ireland and came over to, like Laura Irish probably did in the time, to have a better life and try and earn some money. She was, I think she was 21 when she moved over here.
Yeah, and 25 when she was
25 when she died. So one of the younger ones. The thing is, though, it's like a sad story again. She met a man, Joseph Barnett. They moved in together quite early. He lost his job, they argued, he moved out, she turned to drink, she then became a part-time sex worker.
Yeah.
And it is just, honestly, the thing is, she had been out drinking that night quite heavily.
Yeah.
And she was heard singing in her rooms,
apparently,
at stupid o'clock in the morning. And then the singing, there'd a noise, a muffled, maybe a cry or something, and then nothing. And it wasn't until the next morning that the landlord said, excuse me, Mary's late with the rent.
Yeah.
Sent an assistant round to get the rent. She was on a ground floor room.
Yeah.
Couldn't get any answer, looked through and saw this body and then had to call the tenant, the landlord and the police. And it's, again, I'm not going to read this. I'm not going to read this all because, I've managed to get the post-mortem and it's just unbelievable. But I think the killer had actually cut her neck in two places, left and right, right down to the bone again. In this case, rather than the odd organ being removed, he'd actually carved out the entire abdominal cavity. Everything had been cut out. And he strategically put parts of her face, her breast, her organs, part of her left arm, and he placed them around the body and even put bits of flesh on a table. And a heart was missing as well.
Yeah.
They couldn't find a heart.
So, again, trophy.
It's hard. I mean, we are ourselves a bit desensitised to stuff. We see lots of stuff today, violence on video games, on TV and programmes. But to think that this actually happened, it's not a movie.
No.
It's not a horror story.
It's not.
You can't explain it.
And the thing is, I think the coroner at the time, he reckoned that it would have taken at least 2 hours to do the kind of disfigurement and disemboweling that he did.
Because it wasn't a frenzy.
No.
It was precision.
It was precision.
Precision. How he did it, yeah.
Yeah, two hours and no one any the wiser.
The one, I won't say nothing's good come out of this whatsoever, but out of all these five murders, this was the only one where a police photographer was called to the room to take photographs at the scene rather than at the autopsy.
Yeah.
And it now is known as the most earliest crime scene photograph to date.
Right.
And then from then on, the police started taking photographs of the actual crime scene. So it allowed the police to actually move forward in some of their actually forensic
It had to. They had to respond. Yeah. And when you think about it then, that became such a standard procedure. Let's keep the room as undisturbed as possible while we take the photos so they could start to build a proper picture rather than have everything trampled upon and taken away. And you would think, I mean, photography was in its infancy back then anyway, so it's almost as if it gave the police pause to actually think, we've got to be better at solving these kind of crimes because the fact is London was in terror. Commerce was being affected. Questions were being asked in the Houses of Parliament, and it became such a scandal that the murderer was never caught. It cost the careers of some of the policemen involved.
Absolutely.
And it led to a wholesale change in the way that policing in London was set up as well. And you can look in the history books and find out all about that, because that's fine. It did lead to some improvements in policing. But the fact is, there were five women brutally murdered in the most gruesome of ways, and their bodies mutilated beyond recognition. And you just think, And it was in such a short period of time.
9 weeks.
I know.
9 weeks. And the fact that nobody's ever been caught for it, and never will be now, obviously, since so long ago.
Now, we've kept using the word canonical, and the reason for that is because those five murders are the ones that historians all agree were definitely the work of Jack the Ripper. And the letter I think he sent, was that the 28th of September? Something like that, the letter that he signed, which is one of three letters which we're going to talk about in more detail later. But there were another series of murders included initially by police as part of the Jack the Ripper investigation. And they took all the way through from 88 again, all the way through to this time, the end of 1891. And I think it's worthwhile just mentioning the names of these people and why people initially thought that they were part of it, and then why in the end historians have decided that they're not. So you've got Martha Tabram, also known as Martha Turner, and she was murdered first if you wanted to do it in that way, and she was August the 7th, 88. She suffered 39 stab wounds. It was a departure from the throat slashing and other mutilations. And so, in the end, the authorities decided that she was not a Ripper's victim, which meant that's great, apart from the fact there's another homicidal killer out there that violently, frenziedly murdered a woman.
It was more frenzied, because it was like, so it was 30-odd stab wounds going to the chest and the abdomen.
Yeah.
I don't think the throat was cut.
No,
There was no mutilation afterwards.
No. And then you got Rose Milet on December the 20th, 1888. She was found strangled in Clark's yard. And she, because of that location and timing, they thought that, again, she might be a victim of the Ripper. But, again, lack of mutilation was indicative, and the throat wasn't slashed, if memory serves.
I don't think it was either.
No. Strangled, but not necessarily.
The one after that as well was a lady called Alice McKenzie. And bear in mind that the Ripper victims ended in the 9th of November, as we know now, 1888.
Yeah.
This lady, Alice McKenzie, was murdered in July 1889.
Yeah.
And panic struck in again that the Ripper was back.
Yes.
Because although it wasn't the same modus operandi as the Ripper,
and the knife was held differently.
Yeah,
the forensic coroner.
There were still some similarities because it's quite a brutal attack.
Yes, and I think in the end the police decided it was a copycat rather than the Ripper himself.
Correct. Yeah,
You've then got Frances Cole in February 1891. She was found under a railway arch with her throat deeply slashed, but with minimal mutilation. Mm. We're saying it like that's a relief, but what we mean is the horror, the horrific activities perpetrated on the five victims that we know were definitely Jack the Ripper are not matched here, even though, again, it's a brutal, senseless murder of a defenceless woman.
And I think because, and it wasn't right, obviously, but because there was, we're talking about a particular time period here, but if we extend that over a number of years, there was lots of murders, and some of them were quite brutal. And anybody's loss of life, however they're killed in a violent way, is tragic and it's bad.
Yeah.
It's just that the five that we identified were, like you say, a step beyond what you would say, they were murdered.
Yeah.
They were brutalised.
Yes.
Honestly, it was
post-mortem brutalised.
In a sadistic way.
Yeah.
Like I said, at the time, the world had never seen that.
No.
Or certainly hadn't been reported on.
No.
And it just was, there was shock.
Yeah, because it's kind of these coincidences that happen and the fact that the explosion of the printing presses at that time, and that's when the murders were happening. It was just like a daily, I mean, sometimes newspapers were like three times a day published in London, out on the streets. But, you know, it's just, so it was constantly, it was like the 24/7 news that you get today, just the same thing over and over again with some extra detail.
But whereas now, not necessarily with some media outlets I won't name, there was no, obviously, regulated rules, and there was no filter, no checkup. So a journalist or a newspaper editor could sensationalise things to sell more papers, without having all the facts. So the fact they're putting out one in the morning, and things have changed, there's one at night, people are just devouring them without understanding, well, has that been substantiated or not?
Yeah, exactly. So, and then there were two more victims that initially they thought might be the Ripper, weren't. There was a mystery victim, a Whitehall mystery victim, because a headless torso was found in Whitehall.
The Pinching Street torso.
Yes.
Right.
So, and there was a dismemberment rather than mutilation, which again is horrific, but even so, it's gone down as not really being the Ripper. And then you've got Elizabeth Jackson then in 1889, and again, her dismembered remains were found along the Thames. And it was very more similar to the Whitehall mystery victim than it was to the other Jack the Ripper murders. So they're all there. We thought we would mention them anyway, because we know that people, when you go on the internet and you start researching, you go, well, we've only talked about five victims, and according to this, there were 11 or 12.
There were known as 11 Whitechapel murders.
Yeah, so that's why we were very careful to use the canonical phrase. Right. Even if we aren't pronouncing it correctly, we think we are. And it's just basically, we just wanted to get that out of the way. Now, we mentioned the letters, and this is where Jack the Ripper got his name.
Correct.
Right. So there were three letters, am I right in saying that?
There was many. There was, to be fair, Darren, there was hundreds of them. But some were people writing letters that were completely hoaxes. Some were people trying to be helpful.
Yeah.
But there was three that stood out that the police actually started to take notice of.
Yeah.
The first letter in question, which was titled "Dear Boss," and it was sent to the police, was dated 25th of September. It was originally considered a bit of a hoax, but within the actual letter, it talked about the next victim's ear would be cut off,
right?
3 days later, Catherine Eddowes' body was found, and part of her ear was missing.
Yes.
So then they started taking this seriously. There was another part of the letter that said, "I will post the ears to you."
Yeah.
Now, that never occurred.
Right.
Because the other ear, part of the other ear, was still intact. But the fact that that letter 3 days before said, "I'm going to cut the ear off," and did, it makes you start thinking, you know, was it hoax or not?
Yeah. Is that the one that was actually signed Jack the Ripper?
Jack the Ripper. Yeah. That's where they first got the name, yeah.
So that's where the name came from. And then there were two other letters that historians, again, and the police certainly at the time, felt were genuine letters. And what did they contain?
Well, they had one's called Saucy Jack, which is a postcard, actually. The thing that's interesting about that is the handwriting was very similar to the Dear Boss letter. And it mentions the murders on the 30th of September. That's where they had two of the victims, which was Catherine and Liz.
Yeah.
And he called it, "I've had a double event this time." And yes. that became known as a double event, that killing. But they reckon the postcard was most likely posted before the murders were publicised, right? Making it unlikely that any kind of crank or orkster had actually written it, because how would they have the knowledge of the crime? Because nothing had been published. The next one, again, and it's always subjective as well, but the next one was titled From Hell. It wasn't sent to the police force. It was sent to the head of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, which was set up during the murders because they didn't think the police were doing enough.
Yes.
So they set up their own little vigilante group to patrol the streets. So this was sent to the head of this vigilante committee on the 16th of October. Now, although the handwriting was unlike the previous two mails, right, it contained a little box.
Yes.
Inside the box was half a human kidney. Now, if you remember what we said before, Catherine Edel's left kidney was removed and taken away. The kidney was then sent to the police. It went to the London hospital to be examined. The surgeon at the time said, determined, this is definitely a human kidney, and it's definitely from the left side of the body. So it questions, if it's a hoax, where did the hoax get that kidney from? It's
kind of like, as well, it gets back to that, these serial killers, although they want to keep their identity hidden, they feel a need to actually inspire fear, definitely, but they also fear... They also like to tease. They like to leave clues to see if you're clever enough. And, I mean, it's fascinating. If you look into the psychology of serial killers, they have almost like a dark desire to be discovered, to be stopped, but they also like the exposure of the notoriety rather than of their... identity.
Which I think why in this case the murders got more and more brutal, because he wanted to get that notoriety.
Yeah.
He wanted to say, like, I can do him worse next time, you know. Yeah. And it's like, you know, look who I am. But did he want to be captured? I don't know. He certainly wanted to be known. There is a little interesting story as well regarding those letters, because much later on, you know, I think it was about 1912, 1913, a newspaper found some evidence, or basically said that these letters were written by a journalist.
Right.
And didn't have a lot of support and evidence, but what he did have was trying to say, look, this journalist is trying to sensationalise it to sell more newspapers. Funnily enough, back in 1931, so you're looking at good nearly 50 years later, there was a journalist named Fred Best, and he had an interview, because he worked at a newspaper at the time in 1888, and he confessed that a colleague of his at the Star newspaper... I'd actually written the letters and signed Jack the Ripper purely to improve the circulation of his newspaper. Now, whether that's true, we don't know.
Yeah, and you do wonder. I mean, this is where it's separating fact from fiction, and there are so many different strands to go down. The strand of, was he a psychopath? Was he someone who was trying to act like a psychopath to cover up something else? You've got the whole... Were the newspapers involved? Were the police involved in a cover-up? Were the newspapers being sensationalistic and trying to sell copies by inventing additional facts and details? And you have to wonder if Jack the Ripper, the real killer, the real murderer, if he didn't sign himself off as Jack the Ripper, would he have been quiet about the fact that someone suddenly said, I'm writing this letter on behalf of... Jack the Ripper.
It is interesting because the letter said, I'm Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
Where that name come from, we don't know.
Yeah.
The police mentioned that he was the apron killer originally.
Yes.
They thought he was a butcher. And obviously then they became known as the Whitechapel murderer. And you're thinking, did he really write the letter? Because he thought, no, I'm not that person. I am Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
Or somebody just thought, that's a great name. I'm going to actually do a hoax and get the name changed. For whatever reason that was.
Yeah.
But it's stuck. And here we are, 130, 40 years on. Still talking about it.
Yeah. So we've talked about the murders. We've talked about the poor women that were the victims. And I think it was right that we spent time discussing their lives, because it's so easy to just focus on Jack the Ripper, the killer, and not really understand the horror of what he did.
Correct.
On innocent victims, regardless of what their... background was, regardless of what their profession was, they were still innocent victims.
And there's nothing good you can say came out of this, but I just want to make a point. if we hadn't had Jack the Ripper, and if we hadn't had this history of the last 130 odd years, those women would have never been known. There'd just been another murder, names erased, forgotten about. At least now, it should happen for everybody who's been murdered, you just can't. These people now, and we're pointing out, can remember, the names are known, there are plaques to them. It's a shame there can't be a plaque for everybody, but at least by having this, the little bit, a tiny thing, is that there's remembrance for those people.
There is, and the other only positive thing you could say that came out of this was a change in police procedures, and I think that was important, especially when it became apparent that that atmosphere of fear started to also unleash a lot of prejudices within London society. The Jewish community in particular came under attack from... It was just that kind of anti-Semitism, blame the Jews, just because of one line that was supposedly heard during a chase. It's just incredible, really, that it could turn into that. So it changed policing methods, and it also changed, I think, the way that the authorities and the media began to work together to make sure that stories were given the right amount of factual information rather than just be that sensationalist headline after headline after headline three times a day.
I think there are some other, I'll call them legacies, of the Jack the Ripper story, which we'll probably touch on maybe at the end when we summarise, because there's some other ones as well which I think are important that that came out of it, good or bad, for society.
Okay, so we'll do that at the end then. So let's now take a look at the suspects, the prime suspects that were put forward or at the time, or historians have started to look at in the preceding 200 years.
That's the important part, Darren, because at the time there was probably two or three key suspects.
Yeah.
But now, even now today, there's over 100. Because people, every time there's a film or documentary research done, another suspect comes up. And it, you know, even as like 5-6 years ago, another suspect came up. So we're going to deal, there's lots of them. I don't know, I mean, we'll probably deal with four or five of the key ones.
Yeah, I think we need to do primarily the key ones. Otherwise, this could be an episode on its own right, just on the suspects. So, who have you got as your first suspect?
Well, the first one I've got is, because he's probably more of a prominent person, was a Montague Druitt.
Oh, so have I.
Yeah.
So that's great.
So, Montague, I mean, he was a barrister and a teacher. The thing is, as well, he was found dead very shortly after the Ripper's final murderer. So people led him to believe that he was the killer because he had the right skills, right?
Yeah.
However, he committed suicide when he was found in the river, and people speculated, well, obviously he's got remorse about the murders he's done, therefore he's committed suicide, it must be him. The thing is, he was a known homosexual, and he was getting a lot of grief, and he was embarrassed by it, and they reckon he might have taken his life because he couldn't face with the actual shame, senior barrister and teacher, of being an homosexual.
Yeah, because back then, you could still be imprisoned and sent to a mental institution.
You could have 2 years in prison.
Yeah.
2 years in prison
for being homosexual.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, again, basically, the real suspicion on Druitt is, first of all, he's an outsider, homosexual. He was in a position of authority, so he might be intelligent enough to know how to do the cuts. He died and the murder stopped. And on top of all that, he committed suicide, which meant he was mentally unstable. That's the kind of thinking.
Which is it's a bit thin, isn't it?
It is. It's just all circumstantial.
But the reason why, another thing that comes to light is that being a very rich, affluent person, his home was at the side of the river.
Yeah.
So how would he be able to commit these murders, probably covered in blood, who knows, get across the river without anybody seeing this? So it was dismissed originally.
Yeah.
However, what came to light after the murders, his actual barrister's offices were in walking distance of Whitechapel. So he could easy walk from Whitechapel, get to his offices, clean up, wherever it may be. But then, on the contrary to that, at the time, there's many witnesses, because he was a keen cricket player. He was playing cricket in Dorset at the time of the, I think it was a double murder?
Yes, I think so.
And the double murder. My view on that is, he was playing cricket, but there were trains then. He was a wealthy chap. He could get into London and back out in a few hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's speculation. Did he do it or did he not? But he was a suspect at the time.
So one that I've got is Aaron Kaminsky. or Kosminski, Kosminski. Yeah, I think Kosminski. I think I said it right the first
Kosminski.
Time.
Kosminski. Yeah, we'll go with that. Yeah,
yeah.
We'll go with that.
And he was a resident in Whitechapel, Polish immigrant. He fitted many eyewitness accounts, and therefore was a prime suspect identified by the police. He was also physically placed in the right locations, and he exhibited known violent tendencies.
Absolutely. And as well, there was also a witness as well to, I can't remember which murder it was now, but who recognised this person talking to one of the victims,
yeah,
who had occasionally met Aaron and said to the police, that's Aaron.
Yeah.
Afterwards, he said that was Aaron. So they had an eyewitness confirming it was him.
But there was no, you would think that, I mean, the police did bring him in.
Yeah.
They did investigate, but they found no evidence anywhere, either on his person or on his where he lived or where he visited. They found no evidence at all. And he, wasn't he, I mean, certainly for the later murders that may or may not have been Jack the Ripper, he was in an institution, wasn't he?
He was in and out of institutions, yeah, absolutely, at the time. And he was definitely mentally ill, but it was known from his acquaintances, let's call them. He had a great hatred of women, especially the prostitution class, and he'd had strong homicidal tendencies. But yes, he did spend a lot of time as a mental patient.
Wasn't he also very slow, very poorly educated, very...
He wasn't brilliant at speaking English either, yeah.
No,
yeah.
So it makes you wonder.
There is what, I mean, for me, whether this is the time to say this, for me, he's the most, since the actual murders,
yeah,
he's become the most likely suspect. And I refer to something that happened many, 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 many years after the death. No, fast forward now. He was a suspect. We knew he had these tendencies. But as early as 2007, there was a Ripper researcher expert called Russell Edwards.
Yeah.
And he purchased what was apparently a stained silk shawl that belonged to the Ripper victim, Catherine Edowes,
yeah,
and was found at the scene of the crime.
Ah.
So he was fascinated by this, so he purchased it, and he sent it off for testing, paid for it, took 2 years to have it fully DNA tested, and then Edwards then later concluded that the DNA was from Kosminski.
Ah.
Okay. And he named it as Jack the Ripper in his book. Now, that was fine. A little bit circumstantial again. However, in 2019,
yeah,
there's a journal of the forensic sciences, right? They also did some further tests on this shawl. But what they did, they compared fragments of what, I'm going to get a bit technical here, Darren, right, called the, I think it's right, it's the mitochondrial DNA.
Yes.
Okay, which is a specific part of the total DNA of a cell.
Yeah.
And it's basically what comes from your mother.
Yeah.
So it's part of the DNA, yeah, not the full DNA. And what they did, they compared it with samples from living descendants,
yeah,
of Kosminski and Edowes, and did the DNA,
yeah,
and they found the DNA was a match for both Edowes and Kosminski, which is the closest people have got now to saying it was him.
Right.
The problem we've got is, because it's only part of the DNA,
yeah,
not the full DNA, people are still saying...
Yeah, it's not conclusive.
It's not conclusive, yeah.
Yeah, it's not conclusive. So who else have you got on your list, your hit list?
Cutbush, Thomas Cutbush.
Oh, I haven't got him.
Ah, right, okay. So, again, I think there's a tenuous link here, but he was interviewed. He was also a medical student, but he had delusions of grandeur.
Yeah.
He was going to be the best surgeon in the world, all that. And he was a little bit mad. So he spent some time again also in Lambeth Infirmary, which was driven by syphilis.
Yes.
Which then thought, well, obviously he sleeps lots of prostitutes or lots of women, he's got syphilis, so maybe he had an issue against them. But the thing is, the police dismissed it because they said he was quite a weak man, didn't seem dangerous, although he was delusioned, and would be incapable of committing these types of crime.
Yeah.
So after he was interviewed, he was basically let go.
Yeah.
Going back to your police conspiracy thing.
Yeah.
Coincidentally, right, Cutbush was a relative relation to the police superintendent Charles Cutbush, who committed suicide in 1896. after retiring from the Metropolitan Police. That's a fact.
Yeah.
Now, you can read two and two and get five from that, obviously.
Obviously.
But the fact he was discarded and released.
Yeah. See, the problem with this is you look at each suspect and you think, that's kind of like, that's looking likely. And then you look at the next one and it's, oh, yeah, that's looking likely. This is why no one has still managed to come up with conclusive evidence or a conclusion about the killer that everyone goes, yes, I see that now.
Hmm.
So the next one I've got is Sir William Gull.
Right.
Now, this is interesting.
I haven't got that one, but I know he was the actual Queen Victoria's personal physician, wasn't he?
And a personal friend of Prince Albert Victor.
Correct.
And the idea is there were two possible theories put forward about Gull's involvement. One is that he himself was insane from syphilis and therefore was taking out prostitutes in particular because he blamed them for his condition, and he also had the surgeon skills to be able to do it. The other theory is, and this is where we get into conspiracy theories, the other theory is that he was actually covering for Prince Albert Victor, who was known to be a frequenter of some of the brothels.
Correct.
In that area.
And allegedly, a prostitute, not the one of the victims,
yeah,
but a prostitute, actually, she was the mother
of an illegitimate child.
Yes.
And Gull had her committed
to asylum
to keep her out of the way, but then to cover up and to deal with the fact that there was all this other conspiracy stuff going on, created the Jack the Ripper persona and murdered these women just to literally cover the tracks of
Correct.
Prince Albert Victor.
Correct, yeah.
Wow.
But as for Prince Albert Victor being the murderer, being Jack the Ripper,
yeah,
and bearing in mind it was only in the 60s that people start saying, oh, maybe it could have been him, because he was allegedly bisexual, he was a bit effeminate. We knew he frequented the prostitutions in Whitechapel and that kind of areas. The thing is, when you look at the Royal Circuit papers and stuff like that,
yeah,
for the first, I think it was the first two murders, I may have got this wrong, but certainly for at least one or two murders, he was in Balmoral.
Yes.
And there is documented evidence and photographic evidence, yeah, he's in Balmoral.
Yeah.
Now, even in modern transportation, I think to try and get Pratt from Balmoral to London, murder and get back to, I don't think that's possible. So
no,
it's a bit speculation, and I think it puts a slur on his image because of how he was when he was alive.
I can see that being the real... And, of course, if you claim a member of the royal family was a serial killer, or someone connected to a member of the royal family was a serial killer, you're going to sell a lot of books.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, not that we're saying that the people who wrote these books and put forward these theories were purely motivated by that, but you have to consider that, I think, in the history of why suddenly, as you say, in the 60s, this is a theory that suddenly started to gather pace. So, who else you got?
I've got a chap called George Chapman, which is not his real name. His name was Severin Klawowski, but he was named George Chapman because it was a lot easier to pronounce at the time. He was another Polish Jew. Again, that's part of the anti-Semitic stuff that was going on at the time, yeah. But he was not named as a suspect until 1903. Which is 15 years after the murders actually ended.
Yes.
And it was an inspector who actually, a chap called George Aberline, who thought he could have been the killer. The reason being, these are the reasons he thought, he kept very late hours.
Yeah.
We know he worked in the week, so he couldn't do much in the week. And although he had a regular job, he was trained as a physician.
Yes.
Right. But then, the other thing is, after the actual group of murders, this chap, Severin Klawowski, George Chapman, did go on
and murder his wives.
Well, they weren't his wives, they were all mistresses, but in public he always introduced them as wives, right? So he poisoned three of his four so-called wives, yeah?
Yeah.
So people then say, wait a minute, can a serial killer who's insane, can he change his modus operandi from what the Ripper did to suddenly become poisoned? Now, experts in forensic science and
psychology,
yeah, so that wouldn't occur, but others are saying, well, you can if you've done something, if you've got away with it, I'm going to try something else now, try a different way of murder. But
it's interesting, isn't
it? The thing is, though, I mean, it is unusual to do that. I also question as well, when you look at his life, he only arrived in England literally days before the first murder. Okay, he spoke very, very little English.
Yes.
So you've got to ask yourself, would he know the knowledge of Whitechapel? and this murder clearly did.
Yes. This is the only way that he could escape detection after each murder.
Exactly. Yeah. And where to kill them, where to actually stalk them.
Yeah.
Also, if his English is so bad, I was going to converse with the prostitute to say, let's go here, I want to have whatever with you. It would have been very difficult for him to do that. Yes. So there are some reasons.
Circumstantial, again.
But again, it is.
So is there anyone else that sticks out in particular? I see you've got Thomas Neal.
He doesn't stick out as him. I think he was. It's just that he was again, and again, it wasn't until after the murders that he became a suspect and he was questioned.
Yeah.
I mean, he was Thomas Neal Cream, I think his
name
is.
Cream, yeah.
He actually was known as a Lambeth poisoner, another poisoner.
Yes.
Who did kill a minimum of 5, but possibly up to 10.
Yes.
By poisoning them. The reason why he's there is because at his execution
he allegedly confessed.
He said, I'm Jack the Ripper. The problem is he lived between the
UK
US
and US.
The thing is, during all 5 murders,
yes,
he was in a prison.
Yes.
In Illinois, in the US.
So
it couldn't be.
No,
it couldn't
be. Unless he had a jet plane and he could get in
time
and
machine,
out of,
no doubt. Yeah. But he was the things that people are, he became on the list, so people weren't looking at the facts.
Yeah.
He's poisoned these 5 to 10 people.
And he's got medical knowledge.
He's got a bit of knowledge. He's got a bit of history. We know he's been in London at some stage.
And he said he was.
He must be then.
It must be then.
So.
Yeah, again, I think that comes back to the killer wanting notoriety and fame or infamy.
Infamy.
As they say, infamy, yeah. Is there, before we bring this to an end, is there anything else we want to just...
Not about the suspects. I mean, we've named a good half dozen there,
and there are more.
There are a lot more. The ones we've named, 3 or 4 of those, are because the police named them themselves.
Yes.
Some of the others came after the event. I am, if I had to pick somebody, and nobody knows this, so I would pick that Aaron Kozlinski, purely because of the DNA, but it's inconclusive. And although a lot of the victims, you know, the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of the poor ladies who were murdered, are asking for an inquest to be opened, but only the general attorney can do that to do a detailed interest. And he doesn't think there's enough evidence today to spend the time, manpower,
and money
to do that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think this will be a story that runs and runs and runs. I mean, there's already been how many films and TV episodes?
They've been around in the 20s.
Yeah, and we're talking about fictional accounts. We're not talking about documentaries or serious books investigated. We're talking about books that feature Jack the Ripper as a character.
There's been 2 documentaries this year. You watch those and it's in depth and it's using all the science and technology we've got today. Conclusion? We don't know. We still don't know.
And if you think you're going to do a 4-part documentary with modern forensic scientists and equipment and experts, and you still can't work out who did it,
you can't put a finger on it. No.
It's amazing. So this is why it's an unsolved mystery, folks.
Now, it will be forever.
It will be forever.
You've got to think 1888.
Yeah.
You've got to think probably the 4th generation
of
Jack the Ripper, and the victims are still alive. They're obviously 4 generations on. Everybody's died.
Records weren't kept.
Poor
records were kept were probably done away in the Blitz. All kinds of reasons why it's going to be impossible to check him out. But it is fascinating. I think one of the fascinating diversions for me from this was just how many people have been put forward, including people like Lewis Carroll, for example. And you think, what?
It's because he was quite softly spoken, a bit effeminate.
And all that. So, again, it comes down to people being different, suddenly are being brought into the frame.
If you think about, I mean, we've criticised a little bit of the police at the time, which is very easy to do 130-odd years on. But some of the stuff they did, certainly after the 3rd and 4th murder took place, is what police do today. So they started to examine forensic material.
Take photographs.
They took the photographs, certainly the last one. They did door-to-door inquiries. They actually interviewed more than 2,000 people, right?
Yeah.
They investigated 300 and detained over 80.
Yeah. They also swamped London streets to make the public feel safer.
Exactly. And even offered a reward, which was £500. They think, oh, well, them days, that's over £80,000. Imagine £80,000 to somebody who's living in Whitechapel,
yeah,
who knows who it is, and nothing came
and
forward.
Nothing came forward. So, conclusions then. What conclusions shall
before
we
before the conclusion, I mean, you talked earlier about the legacies of Jack the Ripper. Some yeah. of the, I hate to use the word good,
yeah,
but maybe some of the positives that move forward.
Yeah.
You mentioned the fact that police investigations became better. We do know that within two decades of Jack the Ripper murders, Whitechapel was practically ripped down, completely rebuilt,
yeah,
and money and support was given to people who were less well off. So that forced people to their attention on the poverty,
yeah,
people in poverty. Yeah. You've also got to think as well that although it was a sensational of the serial killer in modern history, it then allowed police to understand what is some of the psyche,
yeah,
of a serial killer, what's driving them. And Jack the Ripper case now, in a positive way, is now used to teach people about criminology.
Yes.
And actually help them understand how people's brains might work, the minds might work.
Yeah, because there was a complete denial that someone could be capable of these kind of murders, mm-hmm, especially, yeah, one-off frenzied attack by someone who's gone mentally deranged for a moment, mm, is one thing, but someone who can calculate, plan, execute a series of murders in such a gruesome, horrific, mm, way, that was something that really... I don't think we can blame the police at the time for not having the psyche to accept that that was possible in a way. And even today, such crimes, when you read, as you say, when you read the post-mortems, the horror of it,
mm,
it must, I mean, you just can't get your head around it. And it did actually improve, I think, the way that police would turn to psychiatrists and psychologists for help in solving, mm, crimes, mm, mm, or to get profiles. And the FBI do it extensively now because they track anything that could start to be a serial killer on the loose, and they do profiles, and their profiles are pretty accurate.
Yeah, but then there are other examples of this. But what also Jack the Ripper did, and well, you can say this is good or bad, he's up for debate, but it allowed people to explore more of the macabre,
yeah,
looking at the dark side of history, understanding mystery, and I think some horror came out of that, which is now all general on its own. Well, yeah, like I said, whether that's good or not.
Yeah.
But it fueled that, and it's still, yeah, fueling it today.
Yeah, there's a lot of creativity goes into what came out of that horrific side of things.
That's
from
the word
comic...
That's the word I would have liked to use.
You know, the From Hell graphic novel that yeah, Alan Moore did, the film Time After Time, where H.G. Wells goes in his time machine, tracks the killer, mm, back through time, and it turns out that Jack the Ripper was actually someone from the near future. It's you just think, wow, there's all this creativity going on, mm, and
it's just sad that what will happen for people to, yeah, actually start using it in that way.
Yeah, right. So this is the first of our unsolved mysteries. If it's all right with you, I'd like to do the Roanoke disappearance. This is the community in America that completely vanished overnight with only a single word left to mark their actual existence, carved into a tree that simply said Croatoan. Oh,
I look forward to that one.
Yeah, so we'll do that as our next unsolved mystery. If, and we say this every time we do an episode of ThinkWorks, regardless of the subject, we do have a corresponding post that goes up in the forum, which is darreninform.com/ThinkWorksForum. There's a post, there'll be a post for this show. Come and tell us your theories about Jack the Ripper. We'd love to know who do you think was responsible? Why do you think Jack, mm-hmm, the Ripper became a killer in the way that he did, and why he targeted those women in particular? We'll join in the conversation.
Absolutely.
With you.
And always, we are not experts.
Nope. No.
These are based on research, facts we've found, some of our opinions and views. So if there's any inaccuracies, no, accept them. We know we're not perfect.
Yeah, and we didn't use Wikipedia once.
Nope.
No. We've actually got
books.
Books. This is the thing. These episodes cost us a fortune. So we buy books, and we get films or DVDs or documentaries recorded, and we watch them. It's just something that came out of the conspiracy theory episodes we did, and we just thought, do you know what? There are some mysteries that aren't conspiracies, but they are real mysteries that need people to look at and see what you can come up with. So come and join us for that discussion. We'd love it.
Absolutely.
And we'll see you soon for another Unsolved Mysteries. Thanks very much, Steve.
Thank you, Darren, and thank you, everyone.
And take care, everyone. And remember, if not everyone is a serial killer out there, so don't go about your business suddenly fearing every corner.
And Whitechapel is a very nice area of London now.
It is. Take care, everyone. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to this special ThinkWorks series within a series. We'll be back soon with another episode of Unexplained Mysteries, and of course the normal ThinkWorks format. In the meantime, however, don't forget to drop in your views on this episode on the corresponding forum post. Simply go to darreninforum.com/ThinkWorks forum, find the post for this episode, and tell us your theories on this mystery, as well as what other mysteries you would like Darren and Steve to discuss. Until then, take care all, and we'll see you soon.